Well, Shabbat Shalom. It's good to be with you. Good to have you here. We have a number of guests. We're really glad that you're here with us this morning. We have people listening to our worship service live around the world right now, including our dear friend Diana in Tiberias, Israel. And we're praying for you, sister. This morning, I'll be sharing the first of a two-part message on what it means to serve. Before we go there, let me take another moment and just, I would be remiss in not saying this from the Bema. Many of you know that my mother passed away this past week, and the outpouring of your love has been amazing. Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for the cards, the emails, the text messages, emails, phone calls, and it's just been really, it's been wonderful. The flowers, appreciate it. I wish I could tell you that my mom, you know, was a believer and that we could celebrate in that way. We can't do that. But when something like this happens, if you're wise, you redouble your determination to make the good news known. And just so you know, we'll be going out in a couple of weeks, Alexander and I, to see the family. There isn't going to be a traditional funeral for my mom. Both my mom and dad do things very non-traditionally. But we'll be going out in a couple weeks, and we'll need your prayers all over again at that time for our testimony to my family members. So I appreciate that. And again, thank you for all the expressions of your love. So this morning, our message is called Avodah, and this is part one of a two-part message. The word Avodah in Hebrew has quite a semantic range. It means work, but it also means worship, and it also means service. One word can mean work, worship, service, and it reflects the biblical understanding that we cannot compartmentalize our lives. That you can't say, okay, well, you know, I go to church on Sunday or Messianic congregation on Saturday, and then the whole rest of the week is completely detached and has nothing to do with the other, as though God went away when we walked out. So Avodah reflects that. And so this first part of what it means to serve, we're going to get the foundation this morning. Now, next week, God willing, we'll talk about the practical outworking of it. But there's serving within Messiah's community, and then there's serving those who are outside the faith. And to illustrate just how crucial it is to your soul that you serve others, let's talk about water. I grew up in Southern California, where typically you have to drive a couple of hours to get to a lake. Now, there are 337 inland lakes in California, and that sounds like a lot. But do you know how many inland lakes we have here in Michigan? Over 6,500. And that's lakes that are 10 acres or larger. If you count lakes that are 1 acre or larger, we have over 26,000 lakes in Michigan. And I am a fan of lakes. The system of water cycles that Adonai designed into creation is a wondrous thing, and it's vital to all of life. Every lake, every ocean in the world is both a repository, but also a tributary. It both receives and gives water. Every lake, every ocean in the world is both a repository and a tributary. With one exception, there is one body of water in the world that only receives and doesn't give, and it's called the Dead Sea. It's an apt name. The mineral concentration is so high that nothing can live in it. And if you want your spiritual life to be barren, it's easy. Don't give. Be tight-fisted with your money, don't volunteer for things, jealously guard your free time, don't offer to help where there are needs that are known, just keep taking and taking. Before long, you yourself will be spiritually lifeless. Now, of course, it's far better to give and to serve out of gratitude rather than Rabbi Glenn laying a guilt trip on you or fear. But it is a fact of our broken human nature, our sinful nature, that frequently we have to do the right thing despite our feelings. If we're going to talk about serving out of gratitude, I suppose we should ask what gratitude looks like. Well, first, there needs to be a living object. You're saying, what do you mean by that? There needs to be a living object? Well, you don't give thanks to the universe. Every so often in a Hollywood movie, oh, the universe has done great. You know, the universe has smiled on me. No. Gratitude requires a living object. You don't give thanks to the universe or to the air or to an inanimate object. If you're grateful for something, you thank the one who gave to you or who did for you. What I'd like to do for a few minutes is look at two examples of men who were so grateful for something that was done for them that they couldn't help but offer themselves in complete devotion in return. The first instance is found in Isaiah chapter 6. I invite you to either open your Bibles, click on your phones, look at the screen, if you can even read that. Isaiah chapter 6. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, he writes, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings, with two each one covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, Kadosh, 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 Adonai Tzivaot, Melochol Haaretz, Kvodo. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And by the way, for those of you who don't know, but you see this banner that Roy faithfully puts out for us every week, that's what it says on there. In the middle, it says, Kadosh, 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 holy, holy, holy. Adonai Tzevaot is the Lord of hosts. Melechol haaretz kvodo, the whole earth is full of his glory. And Isaiah writes, and the foundations and the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called out while the temple was filling with smoke. And I would remind you that it was an angel calling out. It wasn't the Lord. Imagine if he cried out. Just the voice of that angel made the whole place shake. This is one of those rare occasions where God has allowed a human being to see him in some limited way. As majestic as Isaiah's description is, the prophet did not see God in all of his unveiled glory, or else he would not have survived. Since because of our sinful condition, no one can look upon his infinite holiness and live. Even in this brief, limited encounter with Adonai, Isaiah was overwhelmed, as we see from his reaction. Then I said, woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Now, few men in history were as righteous as Isaiah. I think we could agree. Isaiah, the ancient Jewish prophet, considered by many the greatest of all the ancient prophets, and arguably the most righteous man on the face of the earth in his generation. In fact, the New Testament writers quote from the prophet Isaiah more than all the other prophets combined. And yet, what was his reaction when he came face to face with the Holy One? He said, I'm a dead man. This, by the way, illustrates the folly of trying to compare ourselves with one another spiritually. I think it's safe to say that none of us measures up to the godliness, the courage, or the dedication of the righteous prophet Isaiah. Unless I'm wrong, somebody want to let me know they think they're right up there with Isaiah. Yeah, I didn't think so. And if he saw himself as desperately sinful, where does that leave the rest of us? You see, the standard of righteousness isn't the guy in the next pew, but God himself. And we would all have to say right along with the prophet, woe is me. And this is the dilemma, the bad news, as it were. Number one, infinite holiness and sinful humanity cannot occupy the same space. Number two, our very best efforts, our own righteousness, falls lethally short. If you're depending on your level of righteous attainment to be able to stand before God on that day, you can kiss that goodbye. And finally, we stand in desperate need of atonement. Now, nothing is written about Isaiah having committed any sin, but that doesn't mean he was sinless. You read nothing in Scripture about Isaiah having any particular iniquity or wrongdoing, but Scripture regards it as axiomatic that sinfulness is our default condition. We came into this world in sin. It's, for those of you who are computer mavens, it's like you came out of the box, got plugged in, somebody hit start, and as soon as that launched, a virus kicked in. No sooner did your life launch than sin kicked in. And it all results from Adam and Eve's rebellion in the Garden of Eden. Even if Isaiah's sin isn't named, in the presence of infinite holiness, he felt it keenly. He knew he deserved to die. Gratefully, the vision doesn't end there. Mercy and forgiveness are about to be shown to him. And this is where we have a foretaste of the gospel. And this, by the way, is why it is complete folly for anybody to suggest that the God of the Old Testament is in any way different from the God of the Brit Chadashah, the New Covenant. He doesn't change. He's always been holy, just, and merciful. Isaiah writes, then one of the seraphim flew to me with a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs. He touched my mouth with it and said, behold, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven. Isn't that great? First of all, I'm really, for Isaiah's sake, I'm glad this was a vision, because, I mean, if it had been an actual live burning coal and touched his lips, he'd have some real pain. But this exchange is an expression of God's wonderful grace and forgiveness. As Adonai affirmed to Moses, he really is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in love and truth. That, by the way, is why we're supposed to forgive each other. If the Holy One, the Perfect One, forgives us for our many sins, how can we not forgive? How dare we not forgive? Imagine, though, for Isaiah, the overwhelming wave of relief that he felt when he heard those words, your sin is taken away, your sin is forgiven. Wow. If you have embraced faith in Yeshua, you know what that feels like. The immense joy of being forgiven and brought into an eternal relationship. No longer that big old question mark hanging over your head. What's going to happen to me when I die? Oh, the relief, the joy of knowing that your name is written in the book of life. It fills you with love and gratitude. Such knowledge transforms a human being. And it translates into action, as we see in Isaiah's response in the next verse. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here am I, send me." An appropriate response to overwhelming mercy and deliverance is gratitude and a desire to do something tangible to express the appreciation in return. No sooner was Isaiah declared forgiven than he jumped at the chance to do something to serve Adonai. It's embodied in that very special Hebrew word, hineni. Here am I. And it's a word that expresses your availability to him, your eagerness to do his will. Some very great men in biblical history said that word, hineni. Here am I. One day, Yeshua was invited to the home of a Pharisee named Simon. This was an extremely religious man, but lacking in grace and love. And at one point, we read in this encounter that a woman of ill repute came into Simon's home, having heard that Yeshua was there. Don't go looking for this, just let me tell you the story, okay? So Yeshua comes to the home of this very religious Pharisee, Simon. And this woman, a woman of ill repute, has heard that Yeshua is at Simon the Pharisee's house. She goes there. She falls at his feet and weeps. And she uses her hair to dry her tears. Now, Simon didn't say anything, but inwardly, we find out he was indignant. And then Yeshua said something to Simon. He said, "I tell you, her sins, and they are many, have been forgiven. So she has shown me much love. But a person who is forgiven little shows only a little love." Simon had not welcomed Yeshua in the customary way of a blessing, of water to cleanse himself. Nothing. Yeshua said, you offered me nothing. She's been weeping at my feet. She has love. Now, I think it's safe to say that you and I have been forgiven of sins much worse than anything Isaiah ever did. And when he was declared forgiven, he jumped at the chance to take that assignment. Have you been forgiven much? Very well. But do you love much? Anyone can talk a good talk, right? But love, the extent of your love, is evidenced in real time by your actions. Love isn't sentimentality. Love is action. Let's consider another example of a man filled with gratitude. We're going to look at Mark chapter 5. So I invite you to turn to Mark chapter 5 if you're listening in. It says, they went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Yeshua got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. What a pathetic situation. This encounter took place right after Yeshua had calmed the storm on the Kinneret, the Galilee, as they crossed at night. Now, the first thing you need to know about the Galilee is just how dismal it was on the eastern shore. You may recall from the words of Isaiah chapter 9 that the Galilee was already looked upon with contempt, right? They called it Galilee of the Goyim, Galilee of the Gentiles. But even to the rough and tumble Galileans, the area on the eastern shore, especially the Gerasenes, was a place you wouldn't want to be stranded alone at night without a cell phone. Matthew refers to the area by a similar name, the Gadarenes. Gadara and Gerasa were actually two of the 10 cities of the Decapolis that were on the eastern side. And notes that there were two dangerous demon-possessed men. Now, Mark focuses on the one who ran to Yeshua rather than away from him. In any case, this horribly demon-possessed man reflects the spiritual pall that hung over that whole region. God's light had not yet penetrated the Decapolis, the 10 cities. And contrary to Jewish law, contrary even to common sense, this man lived among the tombs. The demons living in him gave him supernatural power, but they also tormented him. Let's go on. When he saw Yeshua from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Yeshua, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Yeshua had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." Then Yeshua asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Yeshua again and again not to send them out of the area. So this man came running to Yeshua, but I'll bet you anything the demons inside him were trying to get him to run the other way. And as he fell to his knees at Yeshua's feet, it was a demon who cried out. Apparently the spokesman, as it were, for a host of demons that had taken up residence in this poor guy. Now, a Roman legion consisted of 6,000 soldiers. That doesn't mean there were exactly 6,000 demons in him, just that there were a lot. And they recognized who Yeshua was, calling him the Son of the Most High God. Now, don't misunderstand what's going on here. The demons were not trying to honor Yeshua by calling him by this title, the Son of the Most High God. They were not honoring him. They were trying to invoke his precise name, according to what scholars suggest was the belief at that time that if you pronounced a person's name precisely, you could take authority over them. Well, that wasn't about to happen. Notice also that they acknowledged Yeshua's authority over them. He commanded them to come out of the man, and they're desperately trying to negotiate with him. Let's go on. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. And again, this just kind of attests to just how this region was. Not a flock of lambs, a herd of pigs, was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Yeshua, "Send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them." We'll talk about that in a minute. He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. So apparently demons find it tormenting when they're unable to inhabit a body of some kind. Their preference obviously would be a human body. But if they can take up residence in a human, they can use that person's mind and body for their dark purposes. From a comparison with Matthew's account, they negotiated with Yeshua that he not immediately send them to the abyss, but at least allow them to go into a nearby herd of pigs. They probably figured that would just be a temporary situation. They could go looking for another human being down the road. Well, he consented, and no sooner did the demons enter the pigs than the pigs drowned themselves. Probably, as I said, the demons hoping to flee at that point and seek human hosts elsewhere. Word of this got to town quickly, and everybody hurried out to see what happened. And the scene that awaited them was remarkable. Let's continue. When they came to Yeshua, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Let's stop for just a moment. This is the guy who was screaming through the night, every night, screaming, frightening people, chasing people, living among the tombs, wailing, cutting himself. I mean, this guy could tear chains off, right? Those demons had given him strength. Everybody was terrified of this guy. Now he's sitting there, and he's clothed, calm, in his right mind, and now they're even more frightened. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Yeshua to leave their region. Isn't that tragic? Perhaps it was out of fear of Yeshua's power and authority. Or maybe it was out of resentment that the death of that many pigs represented a huge financial loss. In any case, the citizens of that town begged Yeshua to leave. What a tragic decision on their part. First of all, they had nothing to fear from him. And secondly, how do you measure the worth of a man? Here was this formerly violent, tormented soul now sitting there calmly and dressed and in his right mind. Isn't he worth more than a herd of pigs? But it is the man's response that is our focus. So let's conclude the passage. As Yeshua was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Yeshua did not let him, but said, "Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Yeshua had done for him, and all the people were amazed. The people of the town begged Yeshua to leave. This man begged Yeshua to let him accompany him. What a contrast. And who can blame that man after being set free from so many years of horrible torment? Out of deep gratitude, wouldn't you want to stay right by his side and go wherever he goes? The one who rescued you? Wouldn't you want to follow him, learn from him, serve him out of gratitude? But Yeshua had other plans for this man. So remarkable a deliverance was this that by returning home and testifying to the wonderful grace of God in his life, many more people would become disciples of Yeshua and experience salvation. And the light of the Lord would spread in this once dark demonic region. What I appreciate is the obedience and zeal with which this man complied. I'm sure he was disappointed at not being allowed to go with Messiah Yeshua, but his obedience proved his love for him. Yeshua said, "Go and tell," and he did with zeal. Do you recognize that Yeshua rescued you? You may not have had a legion of demons tormenting you day and night, But you and I were every bit as lost and in desperate need as was this Galilean Jew. In the blinding light of the infinite holiness of God, even righteous Isaiah saw his desperate plight and his need of forgiveness. And when he received it, Isaiah wanted to express his gratitude by doing God's bidding. The righteous prophet and the demon-possessed man each experienced the grace of God, and each responded with love and zealous obedience. Maybe the problem is that it was so long ago for us that we've forgotten. We've forgotten what wretches we were and how much we needed God's mercy. Psalm 103 says, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and do not forget all of his benefits, who pardons all your iniquities, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with loving kindness and compassion, who satisfies your years with good things so that your youth is renewed like the eagle." Well, next Shabbat, Lord willing, we'll transition from the foundation of serving God out of gratitude to the practical outworking of how each of us can serve God, both here within Messiah's holy community and serving those outside the faith. So just a fair heads up, if you really don't want to serve, you'll really hate next week's drasha. But don't play hooky just because I forewarned you. So let's boil it down as we conclude today's message and you go home to hopefully have a restful Shabbat. He didn't redeem you so that you could sit back and be a spectator and soak it all in selfishly. Like Israel, we were redeemed to serve. And so if you are grateful for what Yeshua has done for you, you should want to serve him. You should want to follow him. You should want to tell everyone about him. So, my friends, what are you waiting for? Amen.